All right, I am sitting here with Melinda Snodgrass, and we are, again, at the Tea House. Actually, we're at a restaurant, but we're having high tea before the beginning of the London Olympics. This interview and the interview with Ian Tregellis were recorded back-to-back, so Ian is right here as well. You might hear his voice now and then. And again, you'll hear all the ambient noise and plates clinking and things like that. Hopefully no crashes or anything dramatic. But Melinda Snodgrass, it's almost hard to know where to begin. So we're actually going to begin first by talking about her novels that are coming out right now. She's had a very long writing career, but why don't you tell us about the current releases?
Well, my next book isn't coming out until September. Right. And it's called This Case is Gonna Kill Me. And it's written under pseudonym, Philippa Barnikova. But I'm not going to hide. I'm still, you know, it'll like be open that that's me. Partly for the reason that I didn't want there to be confusion between the things that I write. Because my books that are currently available on the stands under my own name, The Edge of Reason and The Edge of Ruin, are sort of occult thrillers with a male protagonist, more Harry Dresden kind of thing.
And with it, definitely with the political slant to them as well.
Very much so, because these are the books that I wrote because I was so frustrated with this kind of toxic brew that I see between religion and superstition and political public life. And so I, you know, it's sort of the war between religion and superstition and science and rationality. And I come down on the side of science and rationality in these books, but they're not exactly your standard urban fantasy fare. And then when I decided to try a straight up urban fantasy with a female, you know, narrator, first person, I just thought, you know, people would, who like the Edge books would be surprised if they suddenly picked up this other book and it was really different.
And who really liked what you had to say in the Edge books might feel like there was something lacking from your from your legal theory.
Although my editor on my urban fantasy, my female protagonist urban fantasy says, this is not exactly your standard urban fantasy. You keep bringing up issues that don't normally get discussed. And I think that's more a virtue of the world that I'm writing urban fantasy in. Because I'm not writing about tough girls in leather pants with tramp stamps who carry stilettos. I'm writing about a young woman lawyer working in a vampire law firm in New York City.
Hence the term, this case is going to kill me.
Right.
Where death is not necessarily the end of your career in your world.
No, quite the opposite. In fact, there's a tradition in law where you refer to white shoe law firms, meaning a very venerable law firm. So in my universe, they're called white fang law firms.
Okay.
Because the venerable ones are run by vampires. And then the other thing, the reason I started this series is I looked at what was out available in the urban fantasy, and everybody was writing about this sort of society, broadly speaking, with werewolves and vampires and elves. But nobody had looked at how that would affect the levers of power, politics, finance.
Right.
And I thought, that's a world I know, because I was trained as an attorney. In my other life, when I'm not writing, I manage a natural gas and oil company. So I kind of know that world. And I thought, you know, if there really were people who've lived for hundreds of years, they would have a lot of skills that they could bring to bear. And I think they would have a disproportionate amount of power at the top levels of government, finance, and so on. So that's what I decided to take a look at.
And the blood-sucking boss at your law firm.
I literalized the metaphor. And then my werewolves in my universe.
Which we're still talking about. This case is going to kill me.
This case is going to kill me. The werewolves in that tend to be much more like hedge fund managers, or they found black water because they're mercenaries, or they tend to, you know, gravitate into the much more aggressive. So that was that world, which is quite different from the Edge universe, which is a completely different setup.
Right, the Edge universe is also urban fantasy. It's a police procedural, however. Your main character is a police officer. Here in New Mexico, it's actually based out of Albuquerque, whereas This Case is Gonna Kill Me is New York. Correct.
Although the book, I'm actually doing my editorial notes on the second urban fantasy called Box Office Poison, and it's still my young lawyer, but she's in Hollywood.
Okay.
So I'm mining everything I've ever done in my life.
Which means there are a lot of books. Yeah.
So that was why I picked that. And that one won't be available till I don't know when. I mean, I think sometime late next year. But, you know, it is, you do tend to pull what you know. And actually, even my Edge books, he's a young police officer, so I have a fascination with that. But he also ends up managing an enormous international company worth, you know, billions of dollars, because I have a I think that there isn't enough acknowledgement of the power of economics in fiction, particularly in science fiction and fantasy. People seem to build Death Stars, and nobody ever talks about how much it cost.
Sure. Yeah.
And I mean, I remember actually one of the reasons I decided to, another thing that pushed the Edge books, and I was watching Star Wars, and I thought, okay, now they blew up the first Death Star, and now it's like a year later, and they're building another one. And I thought, doesn't anybody go, you know, we really can't afford that. Like, and that bothered me. So I wanted to at least have that a factor in the world.
And so it is a great segue, because Melinda Snodgrass, for those of you who are familiar with the name, has a long history of breaking, shattering the boundaries of speculative fiction. So, again, it's really hard to find another beginning to, like, this whole chapter of your life, but why don't we start with how you originally trained as a lawyer. And that's something Melinda and I have in common. We're two ex-lawyers who ran away.
We ran, we fled.
From our, admittedly, not as crazy Albuquerque law firms. I mean, people definitely work for worse, but yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about that chapter of your life?
I practiced law. It was one of those situations where I went to law school because it was my dad's dream.
Ditto,
yeah. We have daddy issues. Emily and I have daddy issues.
Well, lots of daddy issues. Daddy just wanted me to have a good fallback.
My daddy really wanted me to be a lawyer. Uh-huh. And he had this sort of rose-colored glasses, a view of the law, you know, as this noble profession. My dad was a lot older than my mom, and so I think he just, and by the time I got into it, I knew at the end of the first semester that I really, I loved the law and the study of law, but the attitudes and the ethos of that world, I didn't care for.
Sure.
So I got out of law school, and you know, I graduated, I did very well, I passed the bar on the first try, so you feel like, gosh, I guess I better go to
better
work.
Do this,
So first I went to work as a government attorney at Sandia National Labs. You know, that was really interesting, but what was really interesting were the scientists and the work they were doing. My work was fairly dull. And after about a year and a half, I then segued into working for a law firm, a corporate law firm, which was hard for me because my specialty was constitutional law and legal history.
Sure.
But you can't make a living at that. So
yeah, unless you're arguing before the Supreme Court regularly.
Yeah. Right. You know, and it's very hard to hang out your shingle and say, bring me a Supreme Court case.
Yeah.
So I ended up in this corporate law firm, and I realized that I was not happy. And my best friend was a writer named Victor Milan. And he took me to an autographing, and Fred Saberhagen was there, and Susie McKee-Charnas, and Roger Zelazny, and they did this mass signing at a mall back in the day when there were bookstores and malls and people did signings at them. And then afterwards, I got invited back to the Saberhagen's house for a barbecue, and I walked through the house, and going from conversation to conversation, just eavesdropping, and it was the most fascinating conversations and people I had ever met. Susie was discussing linguistic issues and the effect on culture. Fred Saberhagen was talking about his Holmes Dracula series and how he was getting letters from a man in Transylvania who claimed to be the descendant of Vlad Tepish and actually a vampire.
Oh, wow.
And Roger was Roger. I mean, he was amazing. And I said to Vic after the barbecue was over, I want to be with these people. These are the most interesting people I've ever met. And Vic said to me, I bet you could write if you tried. So I did.
Yeah, and here's the interesting thing. Did you try screenwriting for television, which is not exactly your sort of shoe-in writing profession? And she subbed a script to Star Trek, The Next Generation. And if you've watched the show, you'll know this script. Why don't you tell us about it?
Then I got to know George Martin. who is now my closest friend, mentor, and just, you know, pal. And
yeah, those of you that, if you've got a copy of Song of Ice and Fire, or is it Game of Thrones?
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones near you. If you flip it open, it says this one's for Melinda. This is the Melinda.
Yeah, that was me. So George and I get to know each other. We become very, very close friends. George goes off to Hollywood to work for a show called Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And he calls me about a year into his tenure, 2 years into his tenure in Hollywood, and he says, you know, I've been looking at how this script thing works, and I've been looking at your skills and your strengths as a writer, and I think you could write this. I think you could write these scripts, and I think you ought to try.
Yeah.
And if you do, I will show, if you write a spec script, I will show it to my agent. So I did. I wrote a spec Star Trek script called The Measure of a Man.
Which, if you don't know that episode, you are not a true Star Trekkie. Yes.
And again, I drew on my legal background. I mean, a lot of my career I owe to the fact that I actually got this education.
Yeah.
But I looked at the characters, and I always found Data to me the most interesting because there was a sense of wonder about him that none of the other characters had. And I realized that I could take the Dred Scott decision, which was a famous or an infamous Supreme Court decision about whether African-American slave was a person or property under the law. And I realized I could make the same application to a robot in Starfleet Command.
Right.
And so I wrote a courtroom drama for Star Trek. And George warned me that you never sell your spec script. You never, ever, ever, ever sell your spec script. But I did.
You did, yes.
And then they hired me to go to work on the show about a week later after they bought the script. And that was the start of my career in Hollywood.
Not a bad start. And so you worked on Star Trek for how many seasons?
Season and a half.
And so then season three, she was the story editor, correct?
Correct.
And then you want to tell us more about your tenure in Hollywood, because you had quite a career out there.
I did, and I still keep a foot in that camp. I went from Star Trek to working for a show called Reasonable Doubts, which was about a lawyer and her police investigator. So, and I was the only attorney on the staff for that show. And I remember once we were doing a story break, you know, breaking the script, and I kept pointing out, yes, but we could make this argument, and you could make this other argument. And the other three writers turned and looked at me and said, now we understand why people hate lawyers. Because I kept saying, yes, but.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
This is not apparent.
Sure.
You know? This is how a real lawyer behaves. Uh-huh. And they were like, but that's horrible. And I was then I went from that show to a show called Profiler, which was about FBI guys chasing serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a co-executive producer on that show, consulting producer. I don't remember exactly what they called me. And in between, I wrote a lot of pilots for TV shows that never went to series, and I wrote Movies of the Week,
and you wrote an episode of Sequest.
I wrote an episode of Strange Luck. I wrote an episode of Sliders. I wrote, you know, I did freelance work. And then Odyssey 5. I did an episode of Odyssey 5, which was a great little science fiction show on Showtime.
Fantastic. I mean, you would still use examples from their plotting techniques.
Yeah, it was a really good show. I still don't understand why Showtime killed it, because it was a great show and getting good numbers for them. But strange the ways of Hollywood.
Yes.
Then I came back home, and I went back to writing books and still doing some screen work. And now I'm sort of, like I said, trying to straddle both worlds, writing books and also writing a screenplay for Universal.
Yeah, so let's talk about those first. I didn't realize that your circuit novels you wrote actually before you went to Hollywood, because they're still, people still talk about them. I didn't realize they'd been published that long ago. Which isn't to say that it's that long. Linda is not that old.
But sometimes I feel like I am, I want to tell you.
But it's funny, because when I was in law school, I actually went to law school out in L.A., and people knew that I wanted to be a science fiction writer. I had my acceptance letter from Clarion West, and I was I was about to make my escape. My constitutional law teacher mentioned these circuit books, and he said, you know, there's this fabulous author out there that we were talking about women authors, and we were talking about legal issues in science fiction. He said, there's this fantastic woman author out there. I'd love to meet her someday, and if you ever get a chance to meet Eugene Volokh, please do say
hello.
Okay,
I will.
But, and he said, Melinda Snodgrass, and she wrote these great novels, these circuit novels. And so Why don't you tell us about those? Because it takes a different, it's a different spin on science fiction that nobody else really has done.
Well, you know, I love science fiction. I grew up reading it. I mean, the first book that was ever read to me was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by my dad. And then the very first novel I read all by myself was A Princess of Mars when I was a little kid, Edgar Rice Burroughs, and loved those stories. So it was in my blood. I knew I wanted to write science fiction. And so when I looked around, again, trying to look at something that wasn't the standard everything, well, I'm not a scientist, so I knew I couldn't write a sort of techie, you know, cutting edge.
Right, and a lot of people in science fiction do come from technical backgrounds.
Right.
Such as Ian Tregellis.
Yes, such as Ian Tregellis, who's a rocket scientist.
Yes.
And but I didn't have that background, so I thought, well, I know the law. And I just read a biography of John Marshall, the first Chief Justice of the United States. And while he was being the Chief Justice of the United States, he would periodically get on his horse and go and ride through Virginia on circuit, hearing little cases, you know, so-and-so stole my chickens, you know, I've got this property dispute, while he's the Chief Justice. And I thought, that is so interesting, the idea of still riding circuit. And I thought, what's going to happen when we have colonies on the moon and on Mars and asteroid mining colonies?
Yeah.
Who's going to take the law to them? And so that was the genesis of that idea. And I wrote three books set in that world. And I'm still, you know, George Martin is convinced that it would make a great TV series. And my current producer I'm working with at Universal is also really in love with the idea of doing, but it would be much more Judge Roy Bean in this version than it would be in my books.
Yeah.
So that was where I went. And, you know, the sort of interesting questions. I mean, the basic question was, does the Constitution follow the flag?
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of what I was exploring. So.
Yeah, and, you know, and so these books are still fairly well known for what they had to say, because there's not really anybody who's explored that territory thematically or really in any real sense that I can think of. Can you?
Not really.
And there's a ton of us lawyers who escaped to science fiction.
Yeah.
And yet, Melinda's one of the few that's gone there. Back to your Hollywood career for just a moment. You didn't just freelance. You also actually had a pilot produced. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. I wrote a number of pilots. I think I've written 6 or 7. Only one actually got filmed. It was a show called Star Command. Actually, we wanted to call it Star Rats, but the network wouldn't let us. I thought Star Rats was a much better title. But
it's a palindrome.
Yes, because it's a palindrome. That was exactly why we did it, because we were going to do that in the opening credits.
Have a mirror.
Yeah. But the network said no, and our producing entity said no. So we ended up going with the name Star Command. And it was a real education for me, because we were one of the first productions to shoot in the former East Germany.
Yes.
And the wall had come down not that long ago, and we were in a co-producing deal with UFA, which is a big German production company, and they had a deal in Babelsberg in East Germany at the studio there. And it was actually, for a science fiction writer, very cool, because the Babelsberg studio, and in fact the very soundstage we shot on, is where they shot Metropolis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the Blue Angel.
Oh, wow,
and, you know,
wow,
all these.
Wow.
So there was sort of this history in this funky old 4-story building, and they were shooting on the first floor and our offices were on the 4th floor. So I went to Germany for 2 months while we shot this pilot, and it was a whole new experience for everybody. As my East German line producer said to me, under the communists, it didn't matter how long it took to make a movie. He said, I once made a movie that took 12 years because they're going to pay us no matter what. And so the idea that we had 20 days to shoot a 2-hour pilot was startling to them. So, you know, there were problems and confusions, and I learned how to produce. I wish I'd known how to produce before we started doing it. It would have probably had a better outcome. But there are still parts of that I'm very proud of.
Well, and you've got great anecdotes. Didn't you screen test some notable people?
Oh, yes. Okay, now I'm blanking on her name.
Hilary Swank.
Hilary Swank.
Yeah.
Thank you. Academy Award winner twice over. Hilary Swank came in to read for the the leading lady in my pilot. And I was the only woman on this production team. And I wanted her. She was my character. She was Ollie. And her charisma was unbelievable. I mean, there are some actors, that's why you know they're going to be stars. And she walked in, she gave this reading, she was just amazing. And I said, that's it. And all the men said, I don't know. You know, she's not very pretty, you know, and she's got that kind of square jaw. And, you know, she's just not very pretty. And I was tearing my hair out, and I got outvoted, and we didn't go with her. I mean, the gal we had was quite talented, but when you've read Hilary Swank don't cast her, and then, you know, a few years later she wins the Academy Award, that was frustrating. The other problem we had were the special effects. Oh, my God. So there was this whole thing in Germany where if you took business into the former East Germany, you got all these tax refunds and so on. So there was an architectural firm in, not Potsdam, I will remember the city. So there was this little architectural firm, and they did animations where they would like fly you through a building to show you the design. And so they got the job to do the special effects for my science fiction movie, which they had never done. So we start getting the first cuts of this, and there's one scene in the pilot where they're supposed to be flying through an asteroid field and using the asteroid field for cover because they're being pursued by a much bigger ship. And my American line producer and I are sitting there, and I'm just stunned in horror. I can't speak. But Artie looks up at the screen and he goes, why is there dog food floating in space? Because the asteroids look like kibbles and bits. So needless to say, we ended up having to redo all of the special effects back in Los Angeles, which was kind of devastating. And the other thing I discovered is my scripts shoot very fast in the action sequences. And my director was convinced we were going to go long, and so he kept making me cut the character moments because that's always what they want to cut.
Well, because in Hollywood, the page count is sort of king, isn't it?
Yeah, but you have to, you know, certain people, I mean, you know, Aaron Sorkin's script for West Wing were routinely like 75 pages long.
Which is
hugely long for 1 hour.
Because it's usually a minute a page.
It's, and usually a 1 hour script runs about 57 pages.
Sure.
His were in the 70s, but that's because the dialogue was this rapid fire delivery. And what my director didn't realize is that when I wrote an action scene, it was pretty tight. So he kept saying, well, we've got to cut the script. So he kept cutting out the nice little character moments, which I wanted.
Right.
And the upshot was that the pilot came in 10 minutes short, which is a disaster. It's much easier to have it be 10 minutes long and cut.
Right.
In fact, The Measure of a Man was 20 minutes over.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they had never shot anything that had that much dialogue.
Okay.
And actually, shameless plug, they are going to release the full cut on the new DVDs for Star Trek.
Okay.
But
I'm getting one.
So, you know, there was that problem, and suddenly I had to write filler. And we ended up not only filling with more special effects, we kept stretching out these special effects shots, which are boring, which is what's wrong with modern movies. And then I had to write filler scenes, and they were just filler, because I couldn't get my kids back together to do those character moments.
Right.
They were gone. And so it was a really good lesson in what can go wrong.
Right.
When you're having to work in a collaborative way. I mean, sometimes things go very, very well when you're working in a collaborative way.
Right.
Sometimes there are these sort of unforeseen problems that develop. Yeah. You know.
And so why don't you tell everybody what you're doing now out in Hollywood? We might have to go back to, again, you meeting everybody, Roger and all those people, to sort of set up this story. But why don't we first why don't you tell them what you're working on, and then we'll go back to the backstory.
Okay. I'm writing a feature film for Universal Pictures. It's a new division of Universal called Sci-Fi Films. No, it is not the Sci-Fi Network. It is Sci-Fi Films. It is run by a brilliant young producer and executive named Gregory Novick, who is a huge science fiction fan. Gregory's one of these guys who'll say, oh no, that short story was published in Analog in 1943. You know,
wow.
I mean, he is a fan, and he loves science fiction. And he had read a series of books that I co-created and co-edit with George Martin called Wild Cards. And he loved this series, and he's always wanted to develop it as a feature. And he found out that I controlled the rights. And several years ago, when George was very busy writing this little tiny thing called Song of Ice and Fire,
or some fantasy,
kind of fantasy thing. And nobody's ever heard of
right.
it, of course. But he said to me, you love Hollywood much more than I do. Why don't you take the lead on trying to set up Wild Cards in Hollywood? And so I had been working at that over the past few years. And then Gregory and I met up at Comic-Con, and things went from there, and we got the deal set up, and so I'm doing this feature. So, roll back.
Yeah, now let's talk about what Wild Cards is, because again, it's kind of a major part of science fiction history, I think, the Wild Cards franchise.
Well, it's also part of this sort of weird little form of science fiction called shared world anthologies that became very, very big with Thieves' World back in, what, the 70s? 1970s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And then there were a lot of shared world anthologies. There was Thieves' World and War World and Lievac. I mean, I can't remember all of them. And we decided to do Wild Cards.
And we was you?
George Martin. And then
Roger Zelazny.
Roger Zelazny, Walter John Williams, Vic Milan, Steve Lay, you know, a lot of people, John Miller,
big names,
and also some New Mexico writers that were all just part of this group of friends. And I have to say, it started because Vic gave George Superworld. George obsessively ran this game, and to the detriment of his career. And one day, after a long night of gaming, he said to me, there's got to be a way to make money off this obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why don't we turn this into a shared world anthology?
Okay, I have to pause here. What's hilarious is this is now the third book franchise that came out of role-playing games by this group of people that I've covered in my interviews.
What were the others?
We had Buried Pyramid and Leviathan Wakes.
That's true.
And here, okay. So
yeah,
I did not realize that
that
Wild Cards was another one.
This grew out of role-playing games. So we put it together, and George and I sort of concocted the universe. And I came up with the alien virus because George said to me, I really hate superhero things where somebody gets superpowers because they're hit by lightning while standing in a toxic waste dump.
Right.
We do something else. And I said, well, what if it's a virus, you know, and the aliens test it on Earth? So that was the genesis. And we are now the longest running shared world anthology.
By
ever.
Quite a bit, aren't
By
you?
A long way. Yeah. All the others have ended long ago. But Wild Cards, you know, we trudge forward.
Well, and over the years, a lot of other big names have contributed characters. And Ian Tregellis has also written.
Ian is now one of our stalwarts.
It was through Wild Cards that I got my agent.
Yes.
Yeah,
because she also reps the Wild Card series.
Yeah, and George and me.
And Jane. And
but she, we pulled in, and now we have a new crop of writers, of which Ian is one, but we have Daniel Abraham.
Carrie Vaughn.
Who writes the Kitty books. And here's the really makes us feel old for George and I. Carrie, when she was 16, wrote George a fan letter after she read the very first Wild Cards book and wanted to write. And in fact, made costumes for her and her brother.
And if you go on her site, I think they're still there, a picture of her as Peregrine.
As Peregrine.
And her, is it John Fortune?
I think, I can't remember who her brother was.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they're in costume from Wild Cards, and she still has the letter where George wrote back to her, to her fan letter. And now she's one of our, you know, top writers in Wild Card. We have Cherry Priest, David Anthony Durham.
And you've had characters contributed by Gardner Dozois, Gail
Miller. And all of these people who have brought to this wonderful mix of just great characters and great stories. And I am, in fact, right now putting the final editorial polish on our next volume, which is called Lowball, which is volume number 22 or 23.
Something
I've
like
lost
that.
Count.
We're on a whole new generation of heroes now, aren't we?
Yes,
we younger characters that are.
That was the other thing George and I didn't want, is this retconning where suddenly Peter Parker is 16 again, or suddenly he never married Mary Jane. And if you people get old in Wild Cards,
and die,
and they stay dead. So we wanted, when we brought in new young writers, we brought in new young characters. And it was great because the newer generation, Carrie Vaughn brought in the concept of reality television.
Which is hilarious for a concept for one of your...
Which had never occurred to us, because George and I don't watch reality television. We were like, and Carrie came and said, no, there'd be a show called American Hero.
And the winner gets to be the hero of an American city.
And win $1 million.
Yeah.
So that became, and in fact, I'm going to use that in the movie because it's too good not to have in there. It's such a cultural, reality that we have to address. So.
Yeah. Well, and then the Wild Cards franchise is really, I think, the best example of mosaic novels with so many creative minds coming together to create this world and the sort of give and take of. Well, I created this character. I don't want her dating that character and, working out. And, okay, fine, she has to date this character.
Well, George and I cooked up incentives because that was actually one of the problems of Thieves' World is writers would get, jockeying for position. Who has the most powerful character and who has the wealthiest character. And there was no incentive to work together, so people would just do horrible things to each other's characters.
Yeah, kill them off.
Well, they couldn't kill them. That was the only rule.
They
could do anything. They could torture them, but they couldn't kill them.
Lock them in a basement where they're not going to be heard from.
There was one famous case in Thieves' World where one writer amputated the arms and legs of another writer's character. We didn't want that. George and I wanted... community and comedy rather than fighting. So every time your character gets used in a significant way by another writer, you get a consortium point, and those translate into money. So that kind of encouraged people to say, sure, use my character. Use them ruthlessly. Have at it. And it's fun because love affairs start and breakups happen. But when it works, it's actually kind of similar to television, especially as I've done this lowball book. I'm sort of the executive producer, and everybody's writing episodes of the season, and I get to sort of say, okay, we need this to happen. Can you put this in your story? Because you need to tee this up for somebody else in their story three stories later.
And the whole original idea of the consortium and the points and all of that, you did the legal framework, did you not?
Well, I adapted it. I actually, again, have to thank Lynn Abbey and Bob Aspirin because they had a master agreement for Thieves' World, which they were enormously generous with. They shared it with everybody else who ever started a shared world anthology. But there were these holes in it where people could torture each other's characters.
Sure.
So when George and I took that as a template, we discussed how to modify it to get around these problems. And again, Lynn and Bob were very, very generous with saying, this was a terrible mistake, we could...
This is what caused that.
This is what caused that. And so then I designed the language and the way to get around these things, which actually made it a lot easier to set this up in Hollywood than it would otherwise have been. Because that way they negotiate with George and I. They're not negotiating with... We have 37 people who are contributors to the Wildcard Consortium at this point.
Right, and they have points and shares.
Points and shares in it. And so, if you had to negotiate with all of them, it would be...
Herding cats.
Yeah, and Hollywood, a studio would throw their hands in the air. They would just go, forget it.
We'll go resurrect the Heroes franchise or something.
Yeah, we'll do something else. We're not going to do this.
Yeah. So, the Wild Cards has been in the press quite a bit. It's got George R. R. Martin's name associated with it, so that certainly gives it a certain amount of publicity. But really, the heart and soul and the backbone of this whole project is you right now. Is you're the one who's negotiating with Hollywood. You're the one who's going to be writing the script, and you're really the person they're talking to who's been with this franchise from the beginning to the present day. Am I right about that?
And George, he had to hand off to me. George loves Wild Cards with passion.
Very much.
I mean, in some ways, I think it's because he's an old comic book fan from when he was a little kid.
Yep.
And in fact, the first letter he ever wrote was, I think, to DC or Marvel, where he wrote something for the comments line. But he, he just doesn't have time. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's got this little thing called Song of Mice and
Men.
So he has pretty much at the moment turned things over to me. So I'm honchoing this book. I'm working on the script. I'm talking with Hollywood about making sure the rights deal goes through. Both George and I will be executive producers on the film, but I hope to be a very active executive producer.
Sure, the one who's actually there, hands-on.
Yeah, and hands-on for casting and picking special effects houses and, you know, doing those kind of things. I mean, this is really challenging for me because sci-fi films, we have a limited budget.
Yes.
We, at the most, are going to have about $40 million to make a superhero movie.
Right.
And since routinely the new ones are costing $150 to $200 million,
sure.
I have to do it with, you know, great characters and emotional heart because I can't do it with special effects.
Right, with the big bangs.
With a big, big fight sequence. And I'm actually not sorry because I think that's been really damaging to movie making.
Well, and it's certainly been damaging to people's perception of a science fiction movie, I think. That it's all explosions and, you know, an excuse to blow things up in space.
And no story.
Right.
And no characters you care about. I mean, my favorite recent superhero movie was, frankly, Captain America. Mm-hmm. For the first half, because it's all about heart.
Sure.
And emotional connection. And then the second half is fun, and it's great, but they just blow up Nazi factories
right.
at that point.
Yeah.
And
throw a shield around.
And that's less interesting to me than than this very personal journey for this man and his friendship with the doctor, and those things were a lot more intriguing to me than...
There's another funny side story about Wild Cards. You had somebody... So people would submit characters... to the franchise, and didn't you have somebody submit a character that only lived in people's dreams? You want to tell us that story of a later became Sandman? Neil Gaiman, I guess, back in the day, didn't he submit Sandman?
Well, yeah, Neil was a young writer, and he was not yet Neil Gaiman, or published, or had sold to comics, and he approached George at a convention. I was not there at this convention. So he approaches George and he says, I love this Wild Card thing and I really, really, really want to be in Wild Cards, Mr. Martin. And he said, I've got this character called the Sandman. And George said, well, kid, you got some chops and I like you, kid, but, you know, you need to be published before we can look at you, you know, so get some seasoning under your belt and then come back to us. And by the way, that Sandman won't work because there's no magic in Wild Cards. And that's kind of a fantasy character. So periodically, George will say to Neil, you owe me a percentage of your income because if I had taken you into Wild Cards and Sandman, you would never have become Neil Gaiman.
Right, yeah.
So,
well, he even on the stage when he was hosting the Hugos told that story and his quote was, if I had joined Wild Cards, I would have made about $2,000 by now. Which is sort of between times when Wild Cards have been the big franchise that it is.
Yes. So, that was one of the moments where you go, duh! But,
and then you get submissions like Puddle Man.
Yeah.
Which you might see. Puddle Man's kind of an inside joke, and now all of you will be in on the joke. Somebody submitted a character whose ability was to turn into a puddle.
And it was Bud Simons, actually, one of our writers, who created Puddle Man. And he said, but he's useful. He can sit outside people's steps and make their feet wet. Or he can spy while they're talking, you know. I actually did use Puddle Man in a spec Wild Card script that I wrote a few years ago.
Yeah, I remember reading that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And we used him to very good effect.
Well, I figured that the only real way that a teenage boy would use this power would be to lay in the shower in the girls' locker room in his puddle form and go, woohoo! So that was, because it's... But I actually found a way to make it a useful power in a fight scene. It was kind of fun.
It was, and so showed another side of the Wild Cards virus. It doesn't take people and automatically turn them into superheroes. It can be quite dangerous, and people die, and when you're lucky, actually, you just get some kind of power. If you're really lucky, you get a superpower. But if you're lucky, you survive, and you might get to do something like turn into puddles.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a constant reminder that this is not...
Without a cost.
Yeah.
Well, that was the one thing that our universe has that I think sets us apart from the Marvel and DC traditional comic book universes is that we have a class of people that we call jokers in the Wildcard universe, where the virus, this alien virus, a very tiny percentage of people get superpowers. The vast majority of people get the virus and die horribly. And the people in the middle get twisted and deformed by the virus. They can sometimes get powers as well, and then we call them a Joker Ace. But there is a cost, and that enabled us to write stories about civil rights and issues of prejudice that we could do. And the other weird thing about Wild Cards is it was supposed to start, the books were supposed to start in 1986, but George invited in his friend Howard Waldrop, who's a very venerable science fiction writer, short story writer, great fame. And Howard said, I want to write the first story, and it has to start on my birthday, September 15th, 1946.
Yes.
And because of that, we ended up having the first volume be a historical. Mm-hmm. But it was actually a fortunate accident, because by having to do a history, we got some great stories. Walter John Williams' story, Witness, was nominated for a Nebula, was a fantastic story about McCarthyism in the Wild Card world. And so, you know, I think that also gave us a lot of juice we wouldn't have had if Howard hadn't made that, insisted that that happen.
So that's, you know, and there's so much else, but I don't know that we can cover everything. I mean, you used to be an opera singer. What else have I missed about you? We've got that you work at a oil and gas company.
We can talk about my horse.
Yes,
I have the best horse in the world.
She is also a dressage rider and a very, very good one at that. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
I've been riding my whole life, and I rode my first horse in Taos, New Mexico when I was 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And I rode Western, and then I discovered English riding and jumping, and I did that until I thought, hey, you can get hurt jumping, and it takes longer to heal. And then I turned to dressage. I'm actually thinking about starting the Dressage Riders for Obama, so if you're interested, let me know. Any of dressage riders out there.
Obama will have mounted cavalry.
Yes. And my current horse is a wonderful Lusitano stallion. Lusitanos are bullfighting, trained to be bullfighting horses, but they're turning into great dressage horses. And so when I get crazy from sitting in front of a computer, I go ride my white stallion, which kind of seems like a fantasy thing.
Well, and she even did she's done at least one demonstration, probably several demonstrations for riders, because people don't realize that dressage riding is a set of skills adapted for war. You know, the ability to be able to move units of mounted cavalry quickly, to be able to turn them on a dime,
and
all of that.
Infantry in the face.
Yes. And so, you know, so she's given demonstrations and shown how all of this is done, which I, you know, and she's our resident horse expert whenever anybody has a horse in their riding.
George calls me frequently when he's in the midst of one of the Ice and Fire books, and he says, it always begins, Snod, I have a horsey question. And then we go from there.
I admit now I watch movies and go, oh, they actually got dressage horses for this. Look at what they're doing. And yes, they've turned me into a total horse nerd now.
So having gotten to burble about Vento, I am satisfied.
So we have not even begun to cover your many and varied careers, but let's touch once more on your current books that are coming out, because that's what people can go out and get right now before they get out on Big Little Find and dig up those amazing circuit novels.
Thank you.
So the one that's coming out in September is?
This Case is Gonna Kill Me.
And that's a legal urban fantasy.
Legal urban fantasy. And then the two books that are currently available that you can buy now, both electronically and Dead Tree versions, is The Edge of Reason and The Edge of Ruin.
And the Edge books are written as Melinda Snodgrass. This Case is Going to Kill Me
is written by Philippa Bornikova.
Same person, same background, a lot of the same, you know, witty insights about society.
Yeah, and Vento's in This Case.
Vento as well.
By name. I got my horse in.
So it's hard to, you know, experience everything that Melinda Snodgrass has to offer, but you can certainly begin by looking up those books, and I hope soon a Wild Cards movie, and who knows what else. We'll
see. Thank you, Emily.
Thanks very much.